Hi, everybody. Steve Albrecht from Library 2.0 and thesafelibrary.com. I'm with Molly Rippertello, and Molly is becoming fast and famous for her work in her Massachusetts library. She is in Westwood, Massachusetts, for her support of domestic violence victims. And she has a novel and unique approach to helping domestic violence victims, especially those that are in peril. And she has been covered by CBS and CNN, and that's where I saw her, for putting cell phones into hidden books to give to library victims. So she has an interesting story about this, and the idea that the library can be a focal point and a service agency for victims of domestic violence, do it in a safe way, but give them access to resources that perhaps they don't know about, and maybe give them a safe place to meet with victims' advocates and things like that. So welcome, Molly. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us your library story. How'd you got into library work?
Oh, well, actually, that's a fun story. I had loved reading always. I was a big reader growing up, and I liked teaching. So I always thought I'd be like a high school English teacher. So I went to UMass Amherst, and I did all the fun like lit classes and English classes. And then I was got to the education classes my junior year, and I was like, "Ugh, this is awful!" And I did not want to be a teacher anymore. So I was having a bit of a panic. So I turned on, I was watching TV, trying to pretend this wasn't happening, my like mid-college crisis. And there was an ad for Wikipedia, and it was talking about Jimmy Wales, the co-founder of Wikipedia. And he was talking about in age of the internet and information being so readily available, there was no excuse for ignorance in the world. And that if people came together and could combine information, that we could really solve a lot of problems. And I was like, yeah, right on, Jimmy Wales, cool, cool. And then the next commercial was a Massachusetts libraries commercial. And then that was like my eureka, like, I'm going to be a librarian. And that's what I did.
Fate stepped in.
Fate stepped in.
And you're in Westwood, which is a suburb of Boston, and you're the head of adult services there?
Yes, correct.
So the idea of domestic violence, you know, kind of connected to the library, there's some ways to think about it that perhaps maybe people don't know about outside the library, but certainly library employees, largely being female population, have some domestic violence issues which cross over from home to work. Mm-hmm. Probably more likely is that we see patrons that maybe come to the library with their kids or by themselves that are kind of looking for refuge out of the home or the house that they're in where there's domestic violence. And there maybe it's a safe place for them or their kids to be for some span of time. And also that, you know, you and I have talked about this off camera, which is this sort of movement that judges have made in child custody and divorce hearings that use the library as a meeting space and do your child transfer, you know, in the parking lot, that should be fine. And sometimes we get people running into the library who are, you know, feeling in peril and danger from the situation that's happening in the parking lot. So kind of give me your sense of how you saw the domestic violence issue, you know, from your own experiences and then what you saw in the library as a potential resource.
Well, I can tell you that everybody has had an experience of domestic violence, whether it's 1 in 4 women, 1 in 9 men, or 1 in 7 men, depending on what study you look at. So everyone listening, watching, whatever, has experienced it or knows someone who has, which means that you are talking about coworkers that you know, or you are talking about patrons that come in. There was a study that I read as I've been going through my domestic violence education here, and it was a survey of survivors, and I'm paraphrasing the study, but basically it was about 75% of domestic violence survivors had never even considered using the public library as a resource. And it truly broke my heart because the library is a public space. It's one of the last like third places, those third spaces that actually truly exist. There's no need to pay for anything. It's welcome to everybody. And we have other resources, not just like numbers or hotlines or books. We have meeting rooms where you can meet your lawyer, you can meet your advocate. A lot of the stories I've been hearing from victims now are concerns about digital privacy, digital security. So every library in America has public computers. They have a program called Deep Freeze or a similar program that wipes the computer every time you log on. So you can do research online freely. That is an outlet. And so that's why having cell phones that have these preload information, it makes it so much easier to get this information. Even if you run out of minutes, you can always go to a library and use the phone to like send an email. Libraries are just, they're sanctuaries for all.
So talk to me about how you came up with the idea of the hidden book. I mean, I've seen it, you know, people have them on their shelf to keep their jewelry and guns and things like that, but it's clever to think about the phone idea. How did you come up with that?
So this is like the origin story, as I call it. What happened was I had a friend who came to me and confided in me about their abusive relationship. And because I am a survivor of domestic violence, my thought was, holy crap, you need a cell phone that they don't know about because you need to make your plans to get out. So I happened to have an extra phone at home, on an extra phone line. So I went home. Being a librarian, I put like the hotline in. I put a couple of resources that we have in the state of Massachusetts into the phone, and I gave it to my friend. And I said, "Here, this is the information you need. Don't let anyone know you have it. Don't get, make a fake email, yada yada yada." And I gave it to my friend. And then I checked in about a week later to see how they were doing, and they said, "Oh, I'm doing like the phone's great. Thank you so much. But I can't bring it home because they go through my bags when I walk in the door."
Wow.
And I was like, oh. So we were in the library and I looked around and I was doing a deselection project, aka weeding, and I had a big style of discards. And I was like, okay, we can just make a book safe. How hard is that? I've read a lot of spy novels, I guess. I don't know. It was just, it came to me. And it's hard to make a book safe. It's not, it's hard when you don't know what you're doing. I learned how to make it and now they look pretty good. So I gave my friend, I made a really ugly one though at that time. And I made the safe, gave it to my friend. I said, hide it in here, see if you can get through the door. And it worked. And then they made plans. They used the phone. They never, the person never found out and they got out.
So DV
Proof of
guys are
concept.
too dumb to open books. That's a good thing for us, right?
Yeah.
So the book safe is a kind of an X-Acto knife type of a project, kind of a thing. You're cutting a big square to get the cell phone in there and making it as smooth as possible.
Yeah, I use a rotary cutter, but yeah.
And how did the story get out to CNN and CBS and you became an instant famous person?
So, I what happened? Well, basically, what happened was I decided I wanted to pursue this project. So I was at a different library at that time, and so I decided to leave that job to pursue this full time. And I had some other things going on with my family that, like with my children, so I wanted to like spend time with them. But then my job that I had left previously, so I worked in Westwood, went to another job, and I had always kept a good relationship with Westwood. I was still like a sub there. And the day that I put in my letter of resignation was the same day the person who took my job over put in their letter of resignation. So it was just, so then I went and I like, did more hours. Like I filled in here and there over the summer. I eventually came like the interim, and eventually the town came to me and said, how can we get you back full time? And I said, well, I had like a couple of things I want to talk about. And then I said, I have this passion project that I really want to work on, but I need to do it. It's called the Big Blue Underground. And I told them about it. And the town was so supportive. They said, we'll do whatever we can to help you. Yes. So they true to their word. Like they have a newsletter that they go out. And so we put a blurb in there about my project. And that's how it got the word got out.
It's called Biblio Underground, you said?
Correct. Yes.
Great, cool phrase. And so one of the news folks, maybe CBS, CNN, those people picked it up and got in touch with you.
Yep. And it kind of went on from there.
And if you think about kind of the Massachusetts experience is the same as other states, which is, you know, you talked about there's advocacy groups, and I think there's more of a partnership in domestic violence with prosecutors, police, victims advocates, social workers, and things that's stronger than ever been before. I think that's really based on, you know, kind of post O.J. Simpson, some of these national domestic violence cases involving victims or celebrities, things like that. So, you know, I look at it as, and I'm sure you do too, it's not a you issue as an individual person, it's an us issue as a community, and especially from the prosecution, support, advocacy, law enforcement piece. And you know, it sounds like that you know, Massachusetts has some steps in place that you can help to kind of build your resource list. And I think when you said the numbers that you programmed in, are you talking about the National Domestic Violence Victims Hotline, that kind of a thing?
Correct. Yeah. So at that time, I had, it was just a few numbers, but it was the hotline being the National Domestic Violence Hotline. And then I put some one specific to Massachusetts. So at that time, for us, it was like, and it still is Dove for our county. And I put in information for the Office of Victims Assistance for our state. So just a couple of those resources, but that was at that time. Now it's grown. So I think I have about 90 contacts for national and global resources. And then I have for Massachusetts, I have about like 80 contacts in there. And so that would vary by state though.
So, have you done a YouTube how-to video on how to make a book safe? That seems like your next project.
It's next. It's on the list. I'm planning a workshop right now for the town of Westwood's Women Day luncheon where we're gonna make book safes. And so that will be my trial run of doing a workshop. But that's kind of like where I would like to go. We can do workshops, but more importantly, to then get people talking about domestic violence, especially specifically in municipalities and other local regional organizations together, where so often there are all these great resources and all these people work the same goal, but we don't know the other one exists. So we can get in the room and start talking about these issues together in a way that's kind of like a, I keep liking it to like a, if it was like a paint night kind of thing, right? That's kind of like the vibe I'm going for. I think that we could actually just get a lot of work done that way.
And you're repurposing the old books, which is a cool idea, but in a safety way as well. And I just like the whole vibe. My background in law enforcement is I spent time as a domestic violence investigator for San Diego PD. I did 1,500 cases in 6 years. And what I figured out, my first hour on the job is most domestic violence victims work. It's about 85% of DV victims work, either part-time or full-time. These perpetrators sometimes can't get access to them because they change their telephone and cell phone and apartment and address and car. But you're still at work 8 to 10 hours a day. And I look at, the duty of care that organizations like a library and any other public or private sector business has to their employees includes domestic violence protection. And this is a painful statistic for me, which is I think like maybe 16 states in the United States. Only it could be 13. I think I've heard 16, but a small number, not under 20, have made it as a domestic violence victim is a protected class, and the employees cannot be fired. So think about, you're in a library, you bring this domestic violence history that you have, fear of being assaulted or killed by your current or former partner, to the attention of your library, and you say, well, don't bring that crap in here, you're fired. We don't want this drama in our facility, so you're fired. So now she has two problems, right? No job and same bad boyfriend. So only 13 or 14, 15 states, California, where I came from being one, says two things. One, domestic violence, victimhood as an employee issue is a protected class, like age or race or gender or veteran status or pregnancy or disability, a protected class. And the second is, and then this is in a California statute called Senate Bill 400, which is we have to create a safety plan for our employee at work. Now, it doesn't mean, they have a, armed guard at the house from, the moment they leave till they go home, but we have to do something for them in the branch. Move them to a new facility, move them to a back office, bring in private security, liaison them with domestic violence victims advocates or the police or prosecutors, and do something that creates a sense of a safety plan for this person. So it pains me to think that's not in all 50 states. I'm not sure, what you've heard about it, but that part of it to me is we tacitly punish domestic violence victims who are employees by saying, don't bring your problems to work, and as if they had some control over that. They don't. The perpetrator does.
I've lost during my time, I lost two jobs because of my partner. Two.
So just
One,
coming in and being disruptive and scaring people, and that's okay.
one was I resigned out of shame because it was so embarrassing, the situation that what had happened, where it
Right.
made me look very foolish and it was very embarrassing and shameful. And then the other one was at a lot was at a library. And again, I wasn't fired and like nothing like that, but it was very embarrassing having to talk to my director and the police chief about why we had to not say no to this very kind offer of little free libraries being built near us because they were by my ex-boyfriend who was stalking me and wanted
Right.
to put one outside my apartment.
Right. So,
Little thing. Like, is so, yeah, I think protections for domestic violence victims at work are essential.
yeah, I think part of your message to people too is, I can't get involved in every one of your issues, but I can help you connect to people who do this and that solve these problems. And the shame and embarrassment should not protect you for, keep you from protecting yourself and not stop you from doing the things necessary to feel assertive and empowered. Because if I say I can't go to my boss, I can't go to HR, I can't go to the library director, whoever, then I'm stuck. And you know, if I don't feel supported by their response to these things, like, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, why are you bringing me this problem, or what am I supposed to do about it, or don't let your personal life leak over into the library. What it should be is, hey, I'm sure this was hard and embarrassing and painful, and it makes you fearful and anxious, and I'm sure it was hard to come tell us, but thanks for you that you did. Let's figure out what we need to do. And I mean, that's the message I'm trying to get to library leaders is, don't turn this problem away at your doorstep and say, you know, it's a home issue. It's not any of my problem, because these perpetrators, as you know, show up and make it the library's problem. And then the issue that we have with libraries is, look, when did you know about this? And what'd you do about it? Meaning, you know, our employee was injured or killed by this perpetrator, and you had knowledge, and you didn't take all possible steps to connect this person with resources and protection and help, then shame on you.
Well, yeah, and I think, yeah, I'm not gonna say you're wrong there.
So when you look at I mean, when you think about the employee population for libraries being mostly female, and we have same sex, you know, sexual orientation, domestic violence as well. No question about that. Do you think it's still just this shadow issue that's just not talked about, and there's embarrassment and shame and fear, or do you think we're kind of turning a corner in terms of more empowerment and more sort of assertiveness about reaching out for help?
I'm hoping we're turning a corner, and I'm not sure if it's exactly because we're rah-rah more assertive. I think it's just because the system is unsustainable as is, and it's coming to a head. I mean, if you have the issues that we are currently facing as a country and in these communities and in our public library, because we see it every day, I think there's a mood change in the country, and I'm hoping that as the years go on, we improve. But people are at a breaking point, and you can see people acting more erratically. And I think we need to address it and just call it out for what it is and offer resources. And having open communication and between departments and between different organizations, I think we can resolve a lot of these tensions. From becoming bigger problems, as to what you're referring to, like in the library, spilling in from the parking lot into the building. I think if we ahead of time say, hey, here are the numbers, here's the, we have a contact coming in, we're a satellite program for like this advocacy group. They're gonna have someone coming in talk about restraining orders this week. Like having that information out there and then working with community groups to make it feel safe and make it known, but also open enough that it's still a library service, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. You can do a lot of good.
So, you know, the idea that we have been talking about is you know, you had said a great thing, which is, you know, the library has a third space, right? Work, home, and the library. I think, you know, Starbucks tried to take that from us and make Starbucks the third
Yeah, I
space.
know. You guys don't.
And, you know, we see libraries that have AA meetings for people in recovery. We see libraries that have legal aid clinics. We see literacy programs. I mean, that was the thing when I was a kid. It was always about child literacy and adult literacy. Now those programs are just, you know, at times a thousand. We see senior groups coming in. And you know, one of the things I talk about with library employees is you have to have a vigilance about both ends of the fragile population spectrum. Child protective services, so making CPS calls for kids that are in peril, and that could be involved in domestic violence victims as well. The second is adult protective services, elderly, or developmentally disabled adults that are under that umbrella as well. And we need to call for those types of things. And I think, you know, in my experience anyway, CPS is the call people are more likely to make because they see, well, this kid's in peril, but adults maybe not so much. And then I think domestic violence is kind of one of those, I don't want to get involved in other people's business, and I don't, you know, this is their thing. Where I think library people have to have the courage with a capital C to say, let's talk about this with colleagues and with bosses, if we see it in our patrons, to have the courage to shepherd another employee who's having the difficulty to say, I'll go with you to HR. I'll go with you to your boss, and I'll support you during this conversation. So I think that's the evolution. And you know, one of the things I do in my training classes that I talk about challenging sometimes high risk or really problematic patrons, and one of them is the sexually or racially harassing patron, and that's kind of a shadow issue as well, which is a lot of times female employees are embarrassed that somehow it's my fault or somehow I didn't say the exact right thing to get this guy to go away, which is ridiculous, right?
Thoughts on this
And
too.
the boundaries, you know, that you have to set and enforce for yourself. It's not your fault that this guy's doing these behaviors. And kind of the offshoot of that is I talk about stalking. So I came from California where we have tons of stalkers. We created one of the first stalking laws. I was on a task force with a bunch of other folks back in about 94 to create a stalking law, which is now the model of all other 50 states. They use kind of the California model. And you know this, I mean, you have to be afraid for your life. You have to be afraid for your safety. And you say, oh, the guy's bothering me, sort of irritating. He sends me odd emails. That's not stalking. I'm afraid to leave my house or answer my phone or go outside or you know, see this person in the street because he's going to kill me. That's stalking. And it's a pattern of behavior over a span of time. And I think sometimes what I see with domestic violence victims is either they don't understand that and they let stuff get really bad before they talk to the police, or what they are looking at is a situation that is building, and we should get some energy to stop it before it escalates into their death, injury, or death. And I always say the same thing to women in my classes: fill in the blanks for me. If I can't have you, what's the next thing the guy says?
No one can.
Every woman on the planet about above the age of 10 years old knows that. No, sometimes men do and sometimes men don't, but every woman knows that. And that modality is ridiculous. And so what I say to people is, you know, we take steps in these cases, stalking, for example, after something horrible happens, either legislation or some response, or we should have done more as cops or more as social services and things like that. So, you know, I think what you're talking about in terms of the book phone, you know, book safe phone combination is really for the not only domestic violence piece, but the stalking piece to say, look, I need a phone in an emergency situation, things like that. So I still see stalking as one of those, you know, shadow issues that doesn't get talked about until it actually appears. And it's heartbreaking to me that sometimes we are driven by events, and that's when we make changes.
I remember when one of the first library jobs I had was near an addiction rehab, and my first day, and for younger men, I should say, it was like for I think like 18 to whatever age group it was. It was a
Like
state
a
program,
sober living house kind of
yeah,
thing.
kind of thing, yeah, exactly. And my first day, the director says, in all seriousness, you should wear. I was in my early 20s, not married, not engaged. You should get a fake wedding band because they are going to hit on you a lot. And at the time, I was like, oh, okay. But now, like a decade or two later, I'm like, why do I have to like wear a fake ring? Why can't we just kick the guy out if he's like is offensive or disruptive to staff or the patrons, which
Yeah,
is exactly what.
it's ridiculous. You're
Well, I
not
don't know why we can't
doing
just follow procedure,
it.
and
Right.
I don't know why we don't call people out for what they do. I guess it's like a an assertiveness thing, but I've just gotten to a point where if someone makes a sexist joke in public at the library where I'm working or at home, or not at home, but like if out on the street, I call them out now because it's this is how we have things escalate when we let things slide. Like, oh, that's a personal issue, I'm not gonna get involved, or oh, they were just kidding. Of course, no one would really think that, and it grows and grows and grows. And if we don't take action in whatever ways that we can by calling at a bare minimum, calling things out when they're wrong, i.e., that was racist, that was wrong, that wasn't funny, that's sexist, that's wrong. Like, being having the courage to do that is what we need to do, I think, all of
Yeah, I
us.
mean, there's a lot of studies that point to bystander response. You know, not just
Yes.
letting stuff happen. You go, hey, this is wrong, and bystander response creates a peer pressure that says, oh, I'm sorry, I wish I hadn't done that, as opposed to I'm going to keep doing it because no one said anything. So you're
Right.
exactly right. I want to talk to you about a scenario that I used to use in the police academy to teach baby cops and to new investigators about domestic violence, and it goes back to something you probably heard of, you know, many times, either in your own situation or in people that you know, is why doesn't this person just leave? You know, why doesn't the victim just, you know, how hard could it be to throw your stuff in a box and leave? And this discounts, you know, my pets, my kids, my property, my money, my commingled, you know, furniture and assets and cars and things like that. So I do this
Revenge
exercise.
porn is one. If you leave, I have your porn, I'm gonna release your revenge porn like that.
Right.
Yeah, there's a
Yeah,
lot.
the idea that this person has control over your digital life and your personal assets. So I used to do this exercise, which I th think you'll find amusing, because I would take Monopoly money, like, you know, $25, and I'd pick the biggest cop, you know, in the room, and I'd say, come over here. All right, you and I are, you know, I'm your husband, you're my wife, and I say, okay, I've assaulted you. It's 2 in the morning. You know, I've injured you, and you're afraid to call the police. What are you gonna do? And you say, I'm gonna leave. And I say, okay. And so you leave, and what are you gonna do? He said, I'm gonna get in my car and drive away. Okay. And you're wearing like sweatpants and you have a baby. Okay. I'm gonna go with my credit cards and go to a hotel. You don't have any credit cards. I have them. I'm gonna go call my sisters and, two towns over, and she doesn't want to have you because she's afraid. Well, I don't know. I'm gonna go to the ATM machine. So you don't have an ATM card. I have that. But all you have in your purse is $25. So I give them the $25. I go, okay, you've left the house. It's 3 in the morning. You don't have a credit card. You don't have an ATM card. No one in your family will help you because they're afraid of the perpetrator and they don't want all this stuff coming into their lives. And you have a baby. What are you going to do? And, there's a lot of stammering and hemming and hawing. And he says, I guess I sleep in my car. And I go, oh, okay. So now it's, 7 or 8 o'clock the next morning. What are you going to do? Well, I have to go get baby food and diapers. Okay. How much money do you have left now? About $4. Okay. I put $4 worth of gas in my car and I bought a cup of coffee for a dollar and I drive around all day. The end result of that exercise is what? I go home.
Yeah.
I go, say it louder, please. I'm going back home. Why? Because I don't have any money. I don't have my credit card, ATM. I'm out of gas. My baby needs diapers, food, clothing. I need clothing myself and food. So I guess I'm going to go back home. And I go, see that, everybody? That's why
That's
it's
how it
not so
happened.
easy. That happens all the time. And that's why it's not so easy. So stop saying what people inside law enforcement and people in the, just in the community go, why isn't she asleep? And so I try to use that as an exercise to say, it's not so bloody easy, is it? It's quite hard and dangerous as well, as you know.
Yeah, it's the most dangerous time is when you're trying to leave. That's when you're most likely to die, and it takes like seven. What is it? It's like a 7-7-7 rule, I think, where it takes the average victim 7 attempts to leave, because then it's like there's like a 77% chance that they're going to become a homicide victim if they when they leave. It skyrockets, and then it's like for another 2 years they're going to stalk you. There's like a 77% chance that they're going to stalk you for 2 years afterwards. Which I can attest to being true. I've been stalked. My abuser stalked me until I had my second baby, and perhaps now, who knows? So.
Yeah, and you look at those situations, and those guys have a lot of free time on their hands, and amazingly, some of them have a lot of computer skills to figure out where people are, even when you try to hide your identity. And it's so hard to hide your identity these days because you say, well, I'm not on Facebook or whatever, but then you say, I went to some church meeting and I put our address on there, and they scanned that and put it on the internet, and so there you go. So,
Yeah.
the pandemic made that much more likely, stalking cases and things like that. A lot of people, stuck at home. I was really worried, kind of from a DV perspective with library workers by saying there's so many people that are working from home, so many people that are trapped in houses and apartments and, homes with perpetrators that can't get to work as a sanctuary and don't have access to get out of the house. And it was concerning to me. That time span, we forced, people to be together under a lot of stress. And I'm just sure the DV rates for that stuff, especially, the stuff that was unreported, was just through the roof.
Yeah, I think so. I've seen a lot. I mean, if when you work in libraries, so I work in adult services, so I help people on the computer and I like order the books. And I can't tell you how many times I've helped a young woman print out text messages from some very mean partner who's threatening them, or and that has increased over the past like couple of years too. Is it the pandemic? I mean, probably. I'm not a scientist, but yeah. I think so. I think that's a pretty easy assessment to make.
So some libraries have the capacity to help people print stuff off their cell phones. Yes, I've seen the programs.
Yes.
Okay,
Yes.
so they can print screens off cell phones and things like that, and capture messages and things like that, photos off the cell.
Exactly. And I can tell you that every time I've had someone come needing to do that, they've never told me what they were doing. And I've never but once you can figure out pretty quickly, not reading by still respecting their privacy, like what the content is, it just happens. And I don't charge them. And no one should. Any small kindness you can do for someone who is in a bad situation, like whether you know for certain or you just suspect, do the kind thing. If there's a kind thing you can do, just do it. I.e., don't charge them to print the text messages that they're being threatened for. Just do it.
Yeah, I mean it's not like they're doing it for fun. I mean they're doing it to protect their life and a chance that they may have to have evidence against a person who wants to harm them. So you're absolutely right. So tell me what your plan is in terms of sort of a viral growing of this, an exposure to the wider world. Maybe connection to domestic violence advocacy groups that can support what you're trying to do?
I essentially, I think the big goal is I want to get burnout phones that are pre-programmed with resources into the hands of victims of domestic violence and or anyone else who's in a bad situation. So for example, I say that now I've grown my contacts to include the National Child Abuse Line, I have like the Find a Food Bank hotline. I have the Parent Stress Hotline. That's a favorite. So it's not just, I mean, the program it was conceived out of the idea of domestic violence, and it is always going to be primarily focused on domestic violence victims. However, it's for anyone in a bad situation. I hope that this becomes a national program of some kind. I want to see it become a state by state thing. I want to get, I don't think there's any reason why we can't have libraries serve as disinformation like combat stations, right? Like we like that's like our future is we the librarians are trained to decipher what's good and what's bad, and that matters in this situation. And I'll tell you why. I was working on a phone for someone who was in a different state than me, and I was trying to get resources local to that person into the phone. And I almost added a fake abortion clinic to the contact list because it was such a great front website, you know. And it wasn't until I went just a little bit further that I saw like that it was sponsored by like this very anti-choice group, and then there were like bad Yelp reviews. So I didn't add that, but it would have been so much easier had someone who lived in that state who was a librarian, like an information expert, who was doing that loading of information, because they would know off the bat, like, oh no, that place is garbage. And they wouldn't even almost include it. So this is really, it's going to take a nation of librarians to go through all this garbage information to get to the good stuff, to get the real power of information to the people who need it.
And the other thing I find about librarians is they're good at finding grant money and good at finding grant programs. And it seems like there's a lot of opportunities with counties and Fed. You know, the federal government has VAWA, which is the Violence Against Women Act, and that's something that comes up for renewal every several years. VAWA came out, I think, in '94, and was really been quite powerful about restraining orders and releasing information and domestic violence advocacy. So the Fed's programs, you know, the grants and things that come from the Bureau of Justice Statistics and DOJ and things like that, plus maybe you know, a GoFundMe campaigns, things like that. Is that something you've thought about?
I have a GoFundMe going now.
Okay,
We've
great.
raised almost $15,000. I've started buying phones and making new big burner phones and Book of the Freedom kits. And I have a couple of workshops planned where I'm gonna train other people to make book safes. I'm gonna bring the discarded books, and we're gonna get these kits out to a couple of different organizations on the ground in our area. And once that I've done that a couple of times, I'm hoping that I can prove it is a great model that other states and other libraries can use the scale and use however it makes the most sense for their community.
And how do they get the grant, GoFundMe? How do they get that to you? What's the link or web to that?
If you go to my website, bibliounderground.org, there's a donate button right there.
Okay, cool.
There,
And
you can't miss
we'll put that
it.
in our notes as well. So I've been talking with Molly Rupertello. She is the head of adult services, Westwood Public Library in Massachusetts. And her program for domestic violence victims is just so cutting edge, and no pun intended. The idea of these burner phones and ways that we're using books as kind of self-defense items is just warms my heart. So Molly, thanks very much for your time and attention today to this. And I encourage you to keep on keeping on. And I value and appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you so much.